I'm Virginia Postrel. I'm a contributing editor with The Atlantic, and I write a column called Culture and Commerce, which from time to time has been known to touch on issues of the city. It's a continuing interest of mine. Our topic today is, does the city create or reflect its urban culture? And the more you think about this topic, the actually deeper and more philosophical it becomes, because it starts to ask the question, what is the actor here? What is the city that is creating the urban culture? How can it reflect itself? There's this whole issue of reflexivity. And we have a fabulous panel today of people who are very much involved in the lives of cities large and small, particularly in the areas of the arts and culture. I'm going to introduce them one at a time, and our structure is sort of going to be that we're going to start with a series essentially of sort of case studies looking at specific cities, and then Alan Fletcher, whom I'm sure many of you know from the Aspen Music Festival, is going to kind of give us an overarching view of different forms of cities, and then we'll have a little discussion among the panel and then open it up to you for questions. So our first panelist is Joan Harris, who is deeply involved in the life of Chicago. She is a philanthropist, an arts activist. She's a former commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs of that city. And I want to ask Joan to tell us about what we can learn from Chicago.
Well, thank you. I've written some things down just to keep the rhythm going fast and not get too wordy. And before we were speaking, we were talking about the question before us, and Sydney and I both at one time said the answer is yes. And maybe we could go home. But first, what I would like to do is define what I think a city is before we can get to whether or not it creates or is reflected by its cultural institutions. I would say that a city is an aggregate of its institutions, both nonprofit and for-profit, hospitals, universities, schools, its infrastructure, its highways and sewers and all that stuff, commercial enterprises, governmental agencies. But most important, a city is made up of people. Sometimes the interaction produces cacophony. As you've often seen, if you live in cities, you know between neighborhoods and downtown, there's often conflict. Between developers and tree huggers, there's often conflict. Among political factions, I had the rather dubious experience of watching city government go from a traditional all-white run city government to a government run by its first black mayor, and back again to a government run by the white establishment. And there was a lot of differences and conflict. But sometimes the various constituencies in a city can produce a glorious effect. And that's when everybody is singing from the same hymnal, the same page. What I would like to do is present a case study to show what I mean when an institution or the culture of a city can be created by the city and then can in turn reflect back to that city what it's created. For many years, it was increasingly obvious in Chicago and to the arts community as well as the funding community that the small and medium-sized performing companies had nowhere to live. There was not a nurturing or an appropriate place for many of them to perform. Several attempts to create an environment or a theater for young, mid-sized and small companies failed disastrously. And then in 1990, at the instigation of the Chicago Community Trust, a coalition of six foundations joined together in what I think was a first to see if a space could be created for the small and mid-sized performing companies of the city, and if it could happen, and if it could, how it could happen. The initial steps were complicated. There was a survey of all the unused theaters in the city and all the green grass slots to see if there was a space for such a theater. Then there was a survey of maybe 125 performing companies to see which ones could agree on roughly the size of the theater needed, the dimensions of the theater, backstage requirements, access to public transportation, all of that stuff. About 12 companies fell out of this survey and eventually became the core of the presenting companies that said they really needed a theater. And they included a small opera company, a contemporary dance company, Mexican Fine Arts Museum, the Old Town School of Folk Music, an African dance company, a dance company presenting very, very avant-garde stuff, chamber music, and on and on and on. Then there was a survey of the audiences to find out where people wanted to go to take part in such a venture. And the answer came back loud and clear. You build it. We don't care where it is. We will come. And that was how the audiences got involved. A 501c3 was created. Land had to be acquired. In the end, the city of Chicago contributed the land on which the new theater would be constructed, and that was the principal contribution of the city. The founding group created a statement of needs, that is, that we could present to an architect that we had to go out and search for and hire. We've visited as many other performing sites in the United States and abroad as possible to learn where the pitfalls lay, where the successes had been, and where the failures were. We developed a business plan. Did I say we had to raise money? We had to raise a lot of money, and we had to establish some financing. All of these were terrible. There were many, many skeptics who said it couldn't be done, it shouldn't be done, you never should do it. And, you know, it just went ahead and we got done. The first companies to commit were very suspicious of one another. They were afraid that they couldn't get the dates they needed in the theater. They were very protective of their subscription lists and their donor lists. It was a little bit difficult. Getting the land was hard, but the city came through and gave the theater an exquisite piece of property at the north end of our beautiful Millennium Park. Five banks declined to finance or to help with the public financing of this theater, and it was awful. But that was then, and that was a long time ago. By 2003, that's just 3 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, the theater opened with 12 founding companies. We were lucky because great acoustics and perfect sight lines made it an instant success. In the very first week, aside from the, you know, kind of fancy opening, Merce Cunningham was there, a chamber music group was there, Mexican female mariachi dancers were there, and there was chamber music. It was the pattern was set for a tremendously interesting, multicultural, broad array of things that would happen. By 2007, the theater is now home to 37 local companies, and they represent a stunning variety of racial, ethnic, and all kinds of cultural things. There's an African drumming company, several new performance companies, choral societies, chamber music, children's theater. An Iranian oud player appeared, sponsored by the Arab American League at one point. This is just a sampling of the kinds of things that have been there. Today, the companies are collaborating very, very well together with the theater on joint marketing, joint fundraising, and advertising. And there's been a whole cultural change within the theater community, from suspicion and, you know, we want ours and you can't have it, to a joint and common approach to how things get done. The theater is furthermore able to subsidize the true rental cost for these companies, and in some cases able to provide technical assistance and going way beyond helping with the cost of the theater. Ticket prices set by the individual companies range from, you know, pretty high for the occasional benefits to moderate for most of the companies to free whenever there's adequate funding available. After about 2 years in operation, the theater was strong enough to begin presenting in addition to renting to the local companies. And in the first year, and it's only presenting of things that will enhance the image of the theater so that the users of the company can, in fact, enjoy the reflected good reputation. Within the first year, we presented the New York City Ballet, Joan Baez, Daniel Barenboim in his West Eastern Divan Orchestra. The Dalai Lama gave a private teaching to 1,500 people from his throne on the set. Next year, the San Francisco Ballet will be there and the Verbier Orchestra. Oh, well. So the dream of creating a company that was only going to be for the performing companies quickly morphed into a reflection of what the city is really like. And that, to me, is the most interesting part of it. The city, this theater, which was created by foundations, by the city government, by individual people, by funders, by dreamers, and by ordinary citizens, in turn, now sees an institution that reflects back to it its values. It mirrors the broad ethnic, racial, and cultural tastes of the city. And I think that's the answer, both. An institution can be created by the city, and it can reflect back to it the glory of the city.
Great. Our next speaker is Anna Lopez, who is the chair of the board of the Toronto Symphony, and we'll talk about Toronto.
Thank you. Well, as recently as 10 years ago, Toronto was in a bit of doldrums. No investments in public arts, public buildings, arts buildings really had been made in recent memory. Attendance was slightly on the decline at many of our arts venues. Arts organizations were posting significant deficits. The TSO, I'll mention that, the Toronto Symphony, of which I am chair now, was close to bankruptcy. We had no music director, and the board was reeling a little bit at that time. But something happened, and what is being labeled the Toronto Cultural Renaissance. Now, Toronto's always been a great city, a city that many visit and always described as a North American city that resembles it being organized by the Swiss. People say it's clean, it's safe, it's this, it's that, it's always. But it needed something. It needed something more to make it truly great. And it was an investment, really, on the part of the government, actually a conservative government at the time. So this wasn't an exercise in what many people think is Canadian socialism, that decided that they would challenge the community and say, we will put up a third of the investment in rebuilding basically all of the cultural institutions if you go out and raise two-thirds of that amount. And that really accounted to more than $1 billion of an investment in a city of 2.5 million people. Now, the city is a truly great city, and it's also a very unusual city. 43% of Torontonians are not Canadian-born. I am one of them. I was not born in Canada. I was not educated in Canada, my elementary school. We receive about 250,000 immigrants a year, with the overwhelming percentage of those immigrants being from non-Western nations. We are well on our way by 2020 to being half the population being visible minority. So all of our immigration, the top five countries right now, are China, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and so on and so on. So we have this very diverse, very interesting population. And all you have to do is take the subway in Toronto, we are statistically more diverse than New York and LA. I mean, it's just, it's a really very interesting exercise. As well, the other thing that has happened is that we have become the financial center of Canada, a sort of a place that we shared with Montreal for a very long time, but given everything in Canada, Toronto emerged as the financial center. So we are also the home of 8 Fortune 500 companies. We're the home of financial services. And so we have really the ability, the dynamism to generate a leadership that really emerged at the same time that the government put out that challenge. And it's a very interesting leadership, and it's a very committed leadership. So what we had really was a convergence of public policy, of government saying we need to do this, of civic commitment and all the volunteers sort of coming together, a strengthened economy, and a level of tolerance and creativity that people often describe Toronto as having, of and a spirit of collaboration across all the agencies as well. So what happened with that cultural renaissance, and what has happened to the $1 point something billion? Well, there's a Gehry addition to the Art Gallery of Ontario. There's a Liebenstein addition to the Royal Ontario Museum, the Crystal, which you may have seen profiled in the New York Times. There's a new Seasons, the Four Seasons Opera House. There's a new National Ballet School. There's a revitalized home for us at Roy Thomson Hall for the Toronto Symphony. There's a new home for the Toronto Film Festival. The list goes on, and we have just held Luminato, this new kid on the block in the international arts world, which is basically everything under the performing arts sun, 100 performances of theater and dance and opera and classical music. Our contribution at the TSO was the premiere of Eric Idle's Not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy who went to Caramore just a couple of days ago, which was a comedic oratorio. So it was music hall meets concert hall. That was our contribution to Luminato. But the attendance, I was describing this to Virginia, the attendance for Luminato, which is in its first, it was its first performance, first year rather, and as an international festival, it hadn't really gone out and publicized, it sort of was publicized within a month of it happening, had a million attendance. So it drew mainly from the community. Edgy stuff, classical stuff, everything was there. But Torontonians came out in force to support this new festival. And it was a city that was really just rejoicing in itself and its creativity. As far as the TSO is concerned, I'll just touch on that a little bit. We have our acoustics were improved in Roy Thomson Hall as part of the building commitment in the city, but there's been a resurgence of interest in the symphony. Peter Ungen, who is coming to Aspen in August and is our music director, has had an infectious quality to just draw in the city into the hall. Our attendance over a 100-plus concert season is at 85%, and which is very high by any standards. Our subscriptions are up 6% year over year. Past 3 years, our books are balanced, and we are doubling the size of our endowment. So, but the one thing I will touch on is our sound check program, which we're very excited about. And this is about, you know, can we reflect the city that we are in? Soundcheck is an online subscription service for under 29-year-olds, and they buy their tickets online for $12. They can buy up to a week in advance, depending on how the concert is selling. And they are truly, when they're in the hall, or I attend one of the sound check sessions, they're really reflective of the city. That's where we really see, our 700,000 Chinese-born population. It's really reflected in the sound check. They're in the hall. Perhaps our challenge is still to bring their parents out, but they're from all the nationalities across and all the language groups across Toronto. So sound check has been a wonderful success. In terms of our challenges, I mean, the criticism that it's a focus on buildings and not programming, it's something that the city is very aware of. We need to do more to build artist space. Artists live in performance space, I think, along the lines of what Chicago, we always look to Chicago, wonderful examples of this. There is a concentration in the downtown of all of these elite institutions that I mentioned, whereas we're a typical city where we're growing more in the suburbs. The core is, the population is relatively flat. So, you know, how do we get people into our institutions when they really make their homes in the suburbs and they travel 1 hour between the suburbs from work? The last thing they want to do is come downtown for an 8 o'clock concert. There's been criticisms that this has been a largely, and I think this applies to all of us here, that these are largely top-down kinds of initiatives, and not enough funding has gone for grassroots, bottom-up sort of investment in the arts. We are still lacking, and I think it's across all the cultural institutions in North America, really good representation at the governance level of the communities that we serve. And we are largely, you know, establishment people, corporate people, people with connections. It's the drive for fundraising and so forth. But a lot of our communities that we should serve and want to serve don't see themselves reflected at the governance level. And of course, we have, you know, we do fight a perception of elitism. You know, how do we, without dumbing down our product, you know, how do we actually create a balanced program that attracts and reflects the city that we live in? And then another challenge is to continue, I think, from my personal experience, to continue to build an awareness that the cultural health of a city is very much part of the overall economic and social health of the city, that there are really three legs of a stool, that, you know, all the three things go together. And when we think of great cities, we think of cities that are safe, that have great culture, that are, you know, that are successful and have high, you know, employment rates and industry and so forth. So that is the Toronto experience. Thank you.
Thank you. Our third speaker may surprise those of you who know him in his choice of subjects. Sydney Harmon is well known as a patron of the performing arts, both in Aspen and in Washington, D.C., but he's actually wants to talk to us about his experience, which is known in the business world for pioneering areas in quality of work life in Bolivar, Tennessee, and in changing the aspect of that community through the work in the business.
Thank you, Virginia. Inspired by wonderful Jane Harmon, the new Center for the Performing Arts will open in Washington on October 1, and that's all I'm going to say about it. I'm hopeful that Garth will make some reference to it later. In the tradition, the holy tradition of the Aspen Institute, I've looked at the subject of this panel and decided to talk about what I want to talk about. And this is a story that I hope you will find of some interest. A quarter of a century ago, I was working full-time, heading my company, and at the same time, I was the full-time president of an experimental transnational Quaker college, Friends World College. At the college, moved largely by the teachings of Ivan Illich in Mexico, Paulo Freire in Brazil, we were doing something, I think, terribly important. We were turning the traditional model of education on its head. That traditional model held that all the wisdom and the information was possessed by the teachers, the faculty. The students were empty vessels into which they would pour that information. The center of gravity of the institution of learning was the faculty, not at Friends World College. There, the center of gravity was the student. The student had responsibility for his own, her own education. The faculty was a resource. I could spend hours talking about that, but I tell you simply that when it worked, it was glorious. Now, while I was running that college, bottoms up, I was running my company in the traditional, authoritative, top-down model. Until an event occurred in this small town of Bolivar, Tennessee, 90 miles east of Memphis. Town of 6,000 people, as retrogressive a city in the United States as existed at that time. The highest rate of alcoholism, the highest incidence of suicide, drug addiction in the country. And the factory which we had inherited in an acquisition was a desperately terrible place. I remember that Charles Dickens came to visit me there and said, "Come on, Sidney, you must be kidding." The town in which the majority of people were black and in which the majority of black people were elderly. If you were 40 years old in Bolivar, Tennessee, and black, you were old. The factory made remote control side view mirrors for the automobile companies. And one of the departments was the polish and buff department, where the people were obliged to hold these zinc castings up against buffing wheels, and the buffing compound, which of course polished the zinc, also destroyed their lungs. There was at 10 o'clock at night in the second shift a buzzer that signaled the coffee break. The buzzer failed. Local management, in its infinite wisdom, decided that was no problem. They knew how to activate a buzzer. At 10 minutes after 10, they moved the coffee break. Into my life moved this wonderful, old, black, uneducated man with the biblical name, Nobby Cross. Nobby Cross' reaction to the change of the time for the coffee break was, "I don't work for no buzzer, the buzzer works for me." I got me a watch, I know when it's 10 o'clock, off he went to his coffee break, his associates followed him, all hell broke loose. There I was, sitting in grandeur in my executive office in, of course, Lake Success, when I heard word of this eruption in Bolivar, contacted Irving Bluestone, who was number three man in the UAW. Tennessee's a right-to-work state. The UAW had organized the plant, and with Irving Bluestone and Michael Maccabee, wonderful psychologist, went down there and briefly stated, we decided that we would apply the model of the college to the plant. And we turned it upside down. It was the first time in American industrial history that an effort was made to alter the traditional adversary relationship between workers and managers. For the first time, this has become commonplace in America since, but for the first time, workers were empowered. We built a school on the premises. It taught not skills, it taught the things that people in the plant knew how to teach and workers wanted to learn. Writing, piano, that kind of thing. It altered totally, not just the culture of the plant, ultimately the culture of the city. When we were done, people in the plant who had been gassed by the city police on Christmas Eve because their party was presumably too noisy, people in the plant ran for the Board of Education and were elected. People in the plant became members of the council. In that plant, we began a daycare center. It led to a community daycare center. In turn, the first interracial gospel performance in the town. By the time I left in 1976 to join the Carter administration, the incidence of alcohol addiction, of suicide, of drugs had dropped precipitously. The town was in process of transformation. I think it's a reasonable model of how industry can, if it chooses to, not only take an appropriately anthropological view of what goes on inside the company, but can have profound effect on the culture of the city.
Next, we go from the small town experience back to Washington, D.C., which you alluded to at the beginning, and Garth Ross of the Kennedy Center. I hope you can talk to us a little bit about the difference between being perhaps in the nation's capital versus other major centers of metropolitan life.
Sure.
Or whatever else you want to talk about.
No, I will, in fact, speak on the topic. What I'd like to talk about briefly is both why and how a not-for-profit performing arts center can be effective and vibrant and important to the community. With the Kennedy Center and hopefully with other art centers in other localities, but I'll just speak for what we're doing, there's a symbiotic and synergistic relationship between the cultural institution and the city, and the hope is that it amplifies the character of that city. In our case, what we are amplifying because of the city that we're in and the unique character of Washington, D.C., is that it's a global cultural hub, and further unique because it forms a nexus between the international all the way down to the local, and there are points along the way that are important to point out. On the international level, it's the home of all the diplomatic corps is all represented in Washington from across the globe. On the national level, there's, of course, the institutions of the National Mall, Kennedy Center, primarily with the performing arts, and then there's also the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress, and more. On the regional level, there's not only tremendous arts community and arts engagement, but tremendous growth. The best example, perhaps, is the Harmon Center for the Arts. Which is a wonderful new facility that's going to be opening in the heart of downtown, adding yet another venue to the city. And the importance of a venue is so many things. It provides more opportunities, but in simplest terms, it provides more opportunities for the artists and the arts, and more opportunities for the patrons. And it's all this issue of access for artists and for patrons. So it's going to, you know, take Washington to even another level to have this additional venue. Further to the regional level, then you go to the local level, and Washington, D.C. is unique because it's like Chicago and like Toronto. It's one of the capitals of immigration and relocation in the United States. So we have this nexus that connects the international all the way to the local, and that's what we feel is unique about Washington. A not-for-profit, multidisciplinary arts center can play a unique role as a common space for the art and for the audience. And when I say common space, to be very specific, what an arts institution like ours is not, is it is not a club where there's a particular type of art that's presented night after night with a particular audience. It's not a community center, which can reach a very specific constituency very faithfully. Speaking of faithfully, it's not a church where you can also reach into other constituencies very directly. And it's not a symphony hall, which reaches another constituency very faithfully and regularly. Now, there's crossover between all of these types of institutions and presenters. But the not-for-profit Art Center, again, not driven by profit, makes artistic and mission-driven decisions, and not being limited to one art form, it can be many things to many people. And then why is that important? What's the value of the common space for art and audience? I feel that it amplifies a unique value of live performing arts, which is that the audience members, and this is so important in this age of technology, there's a sense of interconnectedness that's growing every day because of technology. And that's true, but it's a certain type of connectedness, and it actually also increases a certain sense of dislocation. And we don't need to go into that. I think we all probably agree to that. But in the live performing arts setting, audience members enter into a shared experience, they educate each other, and in the best cases, they cross-pollinate audiences because people are coming from one area, people are coming from another area, not because of each other, and yet they share something and they teach each other about how to respond, about how to appreciate. So the question is, now I'm going to move on to how to do these things, how to pursue these goals actively. To pursue growth in enfranchisement within audiences of diverse backgrounds, and when I say diverse backgrounds, I'm talking about age, I'm talking about economics, I'm talking about ethnicity and cultural perspectives, cultural backgrounds. I basically boil it down to the programming, programmatic choices, artistic choices the institution makes, and the presenting format. And these are both so important to reaching out to these multiple and overlapping groups. On the programming side, now please bear in mind, what I do at the Kennedy Center is I run a program called Performing Arts for Everyone, which is made up of our audience building and outreach programs. Chief among them is called the Millennium Stage, which is a free performance every single night of the year with no tickets required. And we have been doing this for over 10 years straight. So we have had the extreme luxury, because of the great commitment of our of the institution, of the funders, and of the response by the community, we've had the extreme luxury of deriving practice, deriving the principles of what we do from the repeated practice of just being out there doing it. But in terms of the programming itself, free presenting context where there's not the pressure of ticket sales and meeting income goals, it's really a platform for partnerships. We have found over and over and over, night after night, month after month, year after year, that the quality of our programming increases without a corresponding increase to the expense of supporting and presenting that programming by working in partnerships with other organizations of all types. Universities, we have extremely close alliances and programs we present with Georgetown University, Howard University, cultural institutions like the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress, and embassies across the city, and then community organizations. So presenting in partnership, where we provide the venue, production support, publicity, has been tremendously important to, as I said, increasing the quality and diversity of that programming without increasing the expense of carrying this programming forward. And then this next part is something that sort of speaks specifically to what you were talking about earlier, Anna, about how to do programming that can bring diverse groups together. Now, in the free context, I just keep returning to that at this point, because there's a tremendous amount of latitude to take risks when you're not trying to, or to present programming that might feel to you like a risk in the moment when you're making that programmatic choice or designing a festival or what have you. But there are two matrices that I like to think of that I overlay, which is, one has to do with the audience. And on the vertical axis, it's the core audience of the institution, which you just look at yourselves historically. Who are you? Who shows up? Particularly, who's involved with subscription ticket buying? So on the audience side, on the vertical axis, you've got the audience, the core audience. And on the horizontal axis, you've got the new audience. And what you want to always do is make decisions that the art you're choosing is lying somewhere between reaching core audience and new audience, but always both and never neither. Because you don't want to present programming that has a distinct sense of otherness to what the historical and current mission of the institution has been and the character of the programming that has been there. Furthermore, you are just as interested in expanding the tastes of the core audience so that you can loosen the chains of subscription programming. So you're just as interested in in reaching that core audience as you are at reaching the new audience. And then as it relates to arts, there's this other matrix where on the vertical axis, you've got what I call excellence, and on the horizontal, what I call relevance. Never making a choice where you sacrifice excellence just because something has resonance in the marketplace. At the same time, not making the mistake of climbing so high in terms of excellence that you're appealing to the very, very tip of the iceberg, and there's just not a lot of people who can rally around that spot. So in terms of audience building and outreach, that balance between excellence and relevance overlaid the balance of core audience and new audience. Never one, never the other, always that balance. So the partnerships and those two matrices. And then the last thing I'll say is the other way to approach this growth in who you're reaching is the presenting format. And again, not-for-profit arts institutions that have multiple stages and outdoor space and indoor space can really do this very effectively, which is to, the way I look at it, is creating in the programming multiple points of entry. And this relates to cost. Of course, Millennium Stage is always free, but there's also low-ticketed events and higher-ticketed events. And it's really important to remember in terms of cost in the performing arts. Performing arts organizations are killing themselves to raise money to make this art available despite the high ticket costs. The ticket prices, the revenue that is brought in, brings in, you know, at most, let's say 50% of covering the cost of presenting this art. So when you buy a ticket to a Madonna concert and or the Rolling Stones or the Police tour, and you pay, you see the ticket going for $200 or something like that, people don't tend to refer to that and say, people often say in the arts presenting world, yeah, but you know, the ticket prices are so high. That really has to do with what is the art and what is the context. When you're presenting in a Union House an opera that takes a tremendous amount of bodies on stage, tremendous amount of bodies to run that show, and you cannot improve your economic position by just putting more seats in the house. You can't put that in a stadium. So we go out and we raise a tremendous amount of money to make that art available. So there's that. There's the opera, say, on the one hand, that's tremendously expensive despite the fundraising, all the way down to jazz programming where you've got a trio on stage and almost no tech and a couple stagehands, and boom, you've got a $20 ticket. Same with the clubs. They might be more, and they're actually making a profit off of that, down to the free programming. So cost is an important multiple point of entry. The setting or the venue, whether you're doing an outdoor free festival where you're doing social dance on a plaza, Chicago has done this brilliantly. In fact, our program of what we call Dancing on the River Terrace is modeled on Chicago Summer Dance. So you've got the setting and the venue. You've got open spaces, outdoors, indoors. You've got black box theaters, and then you've got all the way to the concert hall and the opera stage. And then finally, the format in the presentation. We're just as committed to proscenium presenting as we are to presenting in an open space where there is interaction between the artist and the audience. And these multiple presenting contexts are very important culturally, too. And one of the best examples I can think of outside of the Kennedy Center is the University Musical Society at the University of Michigan presented a wonderful Arab program that they were so thoughtful in designing. They worked with the community, and they learned a tremendous amount before they started designing their presenting program about what the venue should be like, how the people should be addressed when they come into the hall. Because if you're reaching out to another demographic, you want to reach out to them appropriately, not just say on my terms, but on our terms, and then in time create, on your terms, and on time, over time create our terms. So again, the programming and the presenting format make a big difference in creating that symbiotic relationship.
Fletcher, I'm sure, is well known to this audience from his work in the Aspen Music Festival, but I was very impressed when we were sort of talking about what we might talk about, that he has developed sort of an overview of different issues that occur in different cities. So he's not just going to talk about Aspen, although you will talk about Aspen.
I will talk about Aspen. You know, the Ideas Festival is both famous and infamous for the view from 37,000 feet. And since we've had some very specific and useful information so far, I thought I would go up to 37,000 feet for a moment with you. It occurs to me that a city can become a cultural destination in very short order through architecture and through the visual arts. There could be an individual artist, Warhol comes to mind. There could be an individual architect whose work brings this status. Gehry certainly comes to mind. There could be a great individual collector, and I'm going to go back in time for my list, but you can supply your own, Clark, Getty, Huntington. In the proliferation of important contemporary museum projects today, the public realm is unlikely to be a partner in the same way it would be for a sports team. A sports team can change cities literally overnight, and we can think of infamous examples of that. They are equally following the public, which means they're moving to the Sun Belt and out of the Rust Belt, or they're following money in terms of massive civic support for infrastructure. But an orchestra or an opera company is not similarly portable. I wonder why there is a much more powerful link, it seems, between a performing arts company and its place of origin than, for instance, art or sports. And the Joffrey maybe is an exception that proves the rule. Imagine the Cleveland Orchestra putting itself on trucks and overnight moving to Phoenix. Why is that so implausible? Maybe it's a branding of name and place, which is like a college or university. Similarly, a college or university is not likely to pick up and move following the public to the Sun Belt. In both cases, an interesting factor behind the scenes is tenure. And so it is a worker management relationship, but the tenure of symphony musicians, like the tenure of professors, has a tremendously conservative effect on the life of the institution. And it takes decades for a symphony to change for this reason. It's been generations since there really was a Philadelphia sound, and yet we still think of Philadelphia Orchestra in that way. The strengths and the mystique of what makes Boston Symphony, Boston Symphony, or New York Phil, and certainly Chicago, have persisted remarkably in the face of both marketplace and artistic pressures and changes. But a difference between a performing arts organization and a college, I think, is that a college, like a destination museum, draws both intellectual and philanthropic support from a national and potentially international audience. A tiny town may support a world-class university. A rusting, terminally depressive city may support one of the greatest of all universities. And I won't name names, but I'm thinking about Yale. The future of an orchestra in a city undergoing this kind of change is much, much more uncertain, because the orchestra or the opera company truly depends on the local public, both as its audience and as its financial support. I was active in Pittsburgh during some years when a very stark choice emerged: should the Pittsburgh Symphony continue to aspire to an international position, or should it accept what the city seemed to have accepted, and that is that it would in the future have only a regional importance? Pittsburgh had once been the home of a dozen or so corporations, as Toronto is today, but Pittsburgh had been a national center for major corporations and banks. It had one of the most significant concentrations of personal wealth in America. This was during the late 19th century. But 100 years later, that was all gone. Every single corporation with headquarters in Pittsburgh had been bought up, consolidated, moved to Charlotte, what have you. And so why, many people asked, should Pittsburgh continue to support the enormous philanthropic demands of having a world-class orchestra? Factoring into this was the fact that those great families in Pittsburgh had left a legacy of one of the best foundation cultures in America. It's staggering, the importance and success of civic foundations in Pittsburgh, and I just make a quick contrast, say, to Boston, which has no lack of culture and education, but which has virtually no civic foundation culture. This concentrates the philanthropy in Pittsburgh, interestingly, into the hands of staff. And one's role as an executive director in dealing with an extremely articulate, educated staff culture is very different from dealing with personal philanthropy, and certainly from dealing with corporate philanthropy. That is good, and it's also difficult. And so when this question came up, it really was very much the foundations who were saying, we can go in a direction of biotech, we can go in a direction of civic well-being, we can go in a direction of infrastructure for the people, or we can continue funneling money into the Pittsburgh Symphony. By the way, the answer was happy for Pittsburgh in the end, and things are going very well there, but not every city is having that experience. And I'll just mention as a quick example, because it has so many ties to Aspen today, San Diego faced the, you know, strike two in the life of its orchestra, and it was really a single philanthropist who stepped in and said, you know, the city is in the Sun Belt, the city should be flourishing in all of these respects. For some reason, the equation is not happening between a great classical orchestra and this city, but I personally will take charge of that. And so now a very happy answer for San Diego. Not as happy for San Jose, for instance, for Sacramento, for another instance. Just as an orchestra may linger on years after the necessary civic underpinnings had begun to crumble, it takes generations to build a new orchestra culture. It can't be done overnight. An art museum might become viable in the space of a few years based on a new building, whether or not the collection really supports it. And I don't want to get into controversy here, but we can think of many examples where the building has led the way, and then people hope the collection will grow up into the building. But that doesn't really happen with a concert hall. LA is achieving this result, and it is moving into world-class status. I myself would say not because of the concert hall, but that hall doesn't hurt either. And LA is, I believe, achieving the so-called Lincoln Center effect with its Grand Avenue project. And I'll hope to get these numbers right, but a very few years ago, there was the Music Center. So you had Dorothy Chandler Pavilion and the Mark Taper Forum, and just a few venues with, say, a couple of thousand seats at any given time. Now you add to that Disney Hall, and you add to it the Colburn School with two excellent performance venues. You add to it a new Arts Magnet High School with excellent venues. You add the Cathedral, which can seat 3,000 and is used for all kinds of great music programming. If you'll stretch a little bit, you add the Staples Center, which has 20,000 seats. This is clearly a major civic program, and it is driving a change in population. And a building and redevelopment change for that entire neighborhood, which to my mind only really has a parallel with the 60s in Lincoln Center. But I was saying, the process of building an orchestra takes a tremendous amount of time. So we're seeing, I won't say anything negative about the Great Five orchestras, but we are seeing Los Angeles zoom forward, San Francisco zoom forward. We're seeing regional orchestras in Kansas City, Nashville, Phoenix, Fort Worth, Southern Florida, Houston, coming onto a stage of national importance. But it takes an enormous amount of time. Nothing like, for instance, Audrey Walton's very audacious project in Arkansas. Nothing like that can be done, I think, in the orchestra and opera world.
I'm just going to make, I decided to change the format, which is I'm going to say a couple little things that all this made me think of, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm going to throw in a couple of cities into the mix and remind us of some other types of institutions, which Garth and Alan mentioned some of the sort of ones that are left out of here, but I made this incomplete list of other types of cultural institutions that are important to the life of a city. The ones that are most important to my life are universities, libraries, and museums, but clubs and churches, as Garth rather said. There are literary institutions of various sorts. My mother has been involved in Greenville, South Carolina, in developing a sort of women's literary and arts long-going that publishes a journal and holds readings, et cetera. There are things like coffee houses and bookstores. I mean, I would argue that Starbucks and Borders are important cultural institutions that have reproduced as chains in places where such things didn't exist, an experience that had existed in many cities from locally grown institutions that we've touched on. Sports, popular music venues, everything from giant stadium rock concerts to small clubs. There's public sculpture and architecture. So there's a lot of things. I've spent my adult life in Los Angeles and in Dallas. And the funny thing about living in Dallas for the last 7 years and moving back to Los Angeles is whenever I go back to Los Angeles, I think, God, this city has such history, which is not, you know, what people usually think of. This is such an old city. It has such history. And I was very struck. A wonderful example of the ability of a collector to create a museum institution is what Ray and Patty Nasher did in Dallas. Ray Nasher is a real estate developer, mall developer, and a great patron of the arts, spurred by his late wife, Patsy. They amassed an enormous, wonderful collection of sculpture and other modern art, including some that is in the North Park Mall, which is the Nasher Mall. And they built the Nasher Sculpture Center, which has a Renzo Piano building, which is a beautiful building, which in no way detracts from a top flight collection, which they collected. I mean, it all is one, it's basically one couple gave this institution to the city. I mean, it's a separate nonprofit. That's the kind of thing a young city can do. It doesn't take years. Compared to building a great university or a great library or a great symphony, these things take much, much longer, which is a great, interesting challenge to those of us who are sort of Sunbelt residents. I've also done some work with the a little bit with the Phoenix Art Museum, which has an interesting history because they have an older history from the Snowbirds supporting. Before Phoenix was such a large city, it had a wealthy set of arts patrons who would be there only in the winter. But I want to let you ask questions. Now, our audio folks, do we have mics for questions? Okay, so I can't see, but hopefully you can.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Up here? Hi, I'm Gene Sisko. I'm a real estate developer from New York, and I wanted to thank the Harmons and Harrises for all of their generosity over the years. I have a question. It really relates to things we've been hearing at this ideas exchange over and over, and the question of leadership. I grew up in Chicago. I remember Sir George Schulte, the Picasso's unveiling in the Civic Center in the 50s, meeting Frank Lloyd Wright and a show called The VIPs, little cultural things that were part of my formative history. In terms of leadership, it seems to me, I'd love to hear you comment, a few of you comment on three things: leadership, inclusion, and placemaking. Because a lot of these projects will not happen without leadership. And the leadership coming from the private sector, the wealthier patrons and elders of the city, as well as enlightened government leadership. We all know about Strong Mayor Daley, et cetera. And the next question also reflects this idea of the arts. You've talked about case studies, but talking about inclusion, I've heard a lot about the performances themselves, because they're so inclusionary in being from many different ethnicities, many different places. They reflect the city. And the third thing is placemaking. How does the leadership in getting this done, the programming that provides the inclusion, work with placemaking to create places where people want to be, want to come, want to make that hour drive, with restaurants, with all kinds of other things that create a 1+1=3 experience?
Well, who wants to start? Anna,
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on the question of leadership. I'll give a personal example. A good friend, a Torontonian, was the editor of the Globe and Mail, Canada's answer to the New York Times, and he was just sort of mad as hell at what was happening. He quit the Globe, took over the Royal Ontario Museum as executive director, and it's our Natural History and Artifacts Museum. And then in sort of conservative, WASPy Toronto, he decided to go out and recruit an amazing bunch of fundraisers, hire Daniel Libeskind, and by the way, his drawings were allowed to take place in it, all of their amazing everything, as He was not challenged to sort of soften the angles of anything. It was just put on. And he did it, actually, Libenshkin did it on the back of an envelope. And Bill Thurcell said, yes, you know, we're going to go, we're going to build this. It looks like the crystal that was built and just opened looks like a giant iceberg has collided with a turn-of-the-century museum, and it's huge, and it angled, and it just sits right in the middle of Toronto. But it was about having the courage, and that's, I think, what Bill Thurcell sort of personified. You need that kind of vision, you need that kind of leadership in a city, and you need to bring others into the fold, because they are, you know, all cities have those kinds of people, but sometimes it just takes one person to become the catalyst, be it in a personal collection and then giving it back to the city, but even to say I will apply and become the executive director of a museum, even though that's not my background and I have a vision and, you know, I can make this happen. So
do you know anything about how it, you know, how he was able to persuade them to hire him?
He's a very well-known writer and communicator, and had led a number of major publications. And I guess he was such an out-of-the-box hire, and I think that sometimes that's not a bad thing. An out-of-the-box hire by the arts is, and not-for-profits is something that is becoming more and more common, because people bring just a completely different view of on the way that things have been done, and I agree, things have been done, you know, a particular way. So I'll comment on that. I'll let others comment on
John,
other things.
Yeah. I'm a big advocate for new buildings, and I tell you why. New cultural buildings, older buildings have history. And they have, which is very good, the older buildings carry with them tradition and a certain amount of good feelings. But in this age, in this century, when inclusion is the way we want to go, the older buildings, beautiful as they may be and laden with history as they may be, say something which maybe isn't the most wonderful thing. It's us white folk got here first. Y'all come in. You can come in and see what we're going to do here, and we're changing what we're doing here. But the facade does present something that's off-putting to some of our newer entering audiences and artists. A new building doesn't belong to anybody, or rather, it could belong to everybody. It has no history, and anything can happen in that new building. It's a much more comfortable place for people to come who haven't been going to the opera house or to the concert hall or to libraries or anything else. It's easier to walk into a building that doesn't already have its territorial stuff marked out.
And one of the interesting things in LA, and you talk some about the center that's developed, is what Disney Hall represents to people who are not involved in the art. Disney Hall is the most photogenic building, and you see people, they're like brides and grooms come there and get their picture taken by Disney Hall. And I mean, these people may never go to a symphony performance, but they're sort of claimed the building. And then that also, actually, in this case, maybe at some point we can talk about how we include the suburbs, but you're including these new populations partly by the fact that you're downtown, but again, helping to have some new buildings that don't have that history. Yes, on this side.
Oh, hi. Art Kleiner, editor of Strategy and Business, and I was listening with a lot of interest to the link between cultural activism and community building on one hand, and then workplace activism and community building on the other, with Sidney Harmon's story. And I noticed that the great workplace change stories are rural stories, are stories of rural cities, Bolivar, Topeka, Lima, Ohio. Why is it that there aren't more workplace, cultural, and community sort of stories interrelated in the cities we know? Have you any thoughts about that? Or?
I suppose the question is addressed to me, and I tell you candidly, I don't know. Those places where I have seen consequential work are in essentially small cities, Ohio, Tarrytown, New York. In Los Angeles, a serious effort, a combination of union and a Japanese automaker, Toyota. So although overwhelmingly, I think the really interesting and even constructive experimental work seems to have originated in small cities, there are examples of larger towns. By the way, if I may, as long as I've got the microphone, a quick comment on leadership. Nothing happens in its absence, certainly not in the world that we're talking about. In Washington, the mayor of the city at the time saw both economic advantage and artistic value in what was being done. That made it relatively easy to encourage his participation. More often, or too often, it seems to me, industrial types like Sidney Harmon are encouraged to do this because it bestows a certain elegance and gravitas on them, but they don't know a damn thing about the arts. Ideally, it seems to me, that guy, if he really cares about the arts, has a great deal more to contribute in terms of longevity than in the initial contribution he makes in getting his name on the place.
Over here.
John McCarter from Chicago. And first, a request to join a small crusade to all six of you. I, too, work in a not-for-profit, and those are three words that I really want to ban in combination, because I think anything that starts not in a definition is right away a non-starter. And secondly, the denigration of profit, although we do not make profit in the corporate sense, profit is essential to each of our institutions because that's the way we can reinvest and reinvigorate. And if we find ourselves constantly thinking break even and deficit financing rather than renewal through strong financial performance, I think we do ourselves a disservice. So what I would like to do is to enlist you in the opportunity to ban the words not for profit and substitute public purpose institutions, because I think that captures so much of us in museums, libraries, symphonies, etc. So a request for joining that mini crusade. But the other thing that I really wanted to get your reaction to is I had an occasion to travel by air from St. Louis to Denver, two cities that I've been in many times over the years, but I had never commuted one to the other, because I would always do Chicago-St. Louis and Chicago-Denver and vice versa, since Chicago, as Joan knows, is the center of the universe. Why would anybody go from St. Louis to Denver? But I got to thinking about these two cities. One a river city, the other a railroad city. One oriented north-south, the other east-west. One with a strong ethnic origin, the other really a non-ethnic melting pot. One with a large African-American minority and one with a large Latino minority. One geographically spread out, the other concentrated, one large, one small. One with a manufacturing and industrial origin, the other with a mining and agricultural origin. One with a strong architectural tradition and one really starting it. One old, one new. One with a different nature of the first generation of wealth that was created. And so I tried to assemble all of this into what is the urban DNA of each of those cities, and Chicago as well, and then how do cities set out to renew themselves from that origin of their DNA and continue to flourish. So I would welcome reaction.
Well, I'll comment a little on that. It's a troubling question for St. Louis because it seems to me that the redevelopment project based on music in St. Louis is the jury is very much out on that success. And one might say, for instance, the Civic Center in San Francisco, which is trying to do major building based around music, a new conservatory, the new Symphony Hall and Opera House all already in place, in a troubled zone of the city, and so far not obviously succeeding as urban redevelopment, as opposed to Grand Avenue, where the mixed-use development is already streaming in. Or for Denver, it seems to me, a museum-based culture trying to renovate the city with already conspicuous success, as opposed to St. Louis. So, and I would venture Dallas and Fort Worth also really trying to give a sense of place and excitement to a downtown area. Dallas has a great new hall, but primarily with museums and great collections.
One last question, and then I think we have to wrap up.
I'll make it brief. I don't want to be between us and lunch. Mr. Harmon's story was a powerful one, but what it suggests to me, one, I've never heard it, and my business is communities. My name is Suzanne Morse, and I run the Pew Partnership for Civic Change. But it also suggests that as corporations move out of cities, become global, we don't have branch banks anymore as we did at one time, it suggests to me, or it begs a question, what's the role of the corporation, large or small business, in building the kind of communities it will take to support the arts, support culture, support your mother's literary society, et cetera.
Well, that's so, not supported by corporations.
I know, but what my question is to Mr. Harmon, what they created was a different culture. So let me just ask him directly the question, what was the difference in the change in the factory in that small community in Tennessee, and how could we think about that writ large among the corporate sector?
Well, the specific matter that you're speaking of, it altered both the culture within the factory enormously, and it infected the culture of the city. Simply no question in my mind about that. People regarded themselves as replaceable parts in the machinery at the beginning, and they were so regarded by management. At the end, they thought of themselves as consequential participants, and it not only affected their lives at work, it affected their relationships in their families, and it affected the relationship of the family to the city. Implicit in your comment and your question really is the responsibility of the corporation. That's another seminar, but I do think that that is crucial and that it is totally inadequate if we dismiss the phrase not for profit. We ought at the same time dismiss the notion that the corporation is there only for profit.
Well, and jump in with a commercial, because there's the question about arts leadership, that we have a seminar here, 5 o'clock on Saturday, and Mr. Harmon will be part of that, and I will as well, on arts leadership. But last year, in a seminar on corporate philanthropy and other forms of philanthropy, we concluded something that surprised me only until we concluded it, and then it seemed so natural. And that's that the great examples of corporate philanthropy, Altria, Philip Morris, and Texaco or Mobil Oil, thinking about big music philanthropy and performing arts philanthropy, were always driven by individuals in those corporations and not really by a corporate culture. And of course, Mr. Harmon is a fantastic example of that as well.
All right. Well, I think we'll thank.
Go ahead. It's fine.
Sorry, I was ready. Let Anna get her last word in.
No.
Okay. I'm concerned about standing between you and lunch. And I want to thank our great panelists and also J.P. Morgan Chase, speaking of corporate philanthropy, for sponsoring the City Track. And thank you all for your great participation. Thank you.
Thank you.